Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. I'm really excited for this week's guest because we go back a long way in the digital world, but this is our first time being together in the physical space, and we're joined today by Jesse Daniels, Professor of Sociology at Hunter College. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. This is great.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
We have so much to cover.
Yeah,
and we've been talking before we actually officially got on mic. We've covered a whole bunch of stuff just out in the studio. But even though you know, you're a professor of sociology, from my understanding of your work, and you cover a lot of different issues around digital technology, race, feminism, the intersection of all of those things. So we're going to spend a lot of time in those intersections, but just give like all of our listeners out there just a overview of your work, your area of expertise, and just a broad base of who they're talking to.
Sure. I got a PhD in sociology and studied the happy fun topic of white supremacy. I looked at white supremacist publications, went to Southern Poverty Law Center and studied in their Klan Watch archive. And because I'm old, this was before the internet. And so these were all printed publications. Time passed, the internet happened, and I noticed that a lot of the people I had studied in the print form were moving online. I was kind of curious about that, and so I started tracking those same white supremacists online. Lots of things happened in my life, and I quit academia and went to work in the dot-com world, and had great fun there and learned a lot more about the internet and sort of digital technologies and how the industry works and that sort of thing. Came back into academia and continued that work, wrote another book called Cyber Racism, following up on those same white supremacist groups as they'd moved online and sort of figuring out what that looked like. And
can you give some examples of that? Like kind of publications,
so
what kind of people?
One of the people that I looked at early on was David Duke, who you might have heard about. And he was had an organization called the National Association for the Advancement of White People, and he had a printed publication, and he was one of the people that made it across the internet divide, and he joined forces with this guy Don Black, who started Stormfront. Oh. And they actually have a radio show that they do together, and then there were other people like the guy that started the National States Rights Party, who had a kind of funky newsletter and never made it across to the internet. Same with Tom Metzger, who started White Aryan Resistance and was sort of a prominent white supremacist, and he just never made the transition. So, but I was interested in who made it and who didn't and what the differences were. So one of the interesting things that I found in the sort of new version of white supremacy after the rise of the internet was this thing that I refer to as cloaked sites. So you may have run across this website called drmartinlutherking.org, and it appears to be a tribute site.
Matt recommends that to me all the time. Sorry, wait a second.
I thought I saw him on it when I came in. When you first looked at
it. I've been
resisting
making about 9 out of 10 jokes that went in my head involving Matt and these things, so I want to give myself credit for only doing one.
Sure.
Okay, please go ahead.
I actually discovered it through students of mine when I was teaching at Hofstra University on Long Island.
Long Island.
Yeah, don't get me started. I took a course that I was teaching the kids, just a regular sociology course, race and ethnicity, and I took them into a computer lab and had this crazy idea that we were all going to create web pages instead of term papers. It was the 90s. One of the first things that a student did was typed in Martin Luther King to a search engine, which back then was Alta Vista. And this website came up, martinlutherking.org. And I was like, this looks funky. And I said, scroll down. And we know from web usability that most people don't scroll to the bottom of a page. But if you go all the way to the bottom of the page, you see hosted by Stormfront. Jesus. And by that time, I was already, you know, researching this. So that meant something to me, but it didn't mean anything to my 18-year-old student on Long Island, you know. So anyway, that's sort of the big overview of my work. And in that, I mean, I've also been interested in one of the places I looked at Stormfront and analyzed is this thing called the Ladies Only Forum, for the lady white supremacists.
Matt also likes that site.
Yeah.
What?
Sorry.
It's like farmersonly.com for yeah. white supremacists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it sounds pretty alluring.
Well, yeah. fascinating in various ways.
So yeah. It's like, so it's kind of like just parallel subcultures, and in the sense yeah. of like they like meeting these very specific kind of very sort of boring or social functions that you wouldn't exactly. associate with exactly. terrorists and
right.
extremists, like hey, like gardening for racists. You know, or,
exactly.
okay,
got it. Yeah, exactly. Got it. How was work today? You know, right, I mean, it's right. really, it's really just people presenting, you know, like discussing their life and making connection, and they're doing it under this big umbrella of white supremacy.
Just like I mean, but just like any of us would do in any kind of shared values community.
Absolutely.
Right.
Exactly the same.
It sounds like this background in white supremacy is perfectly suited for the times. That we live in today.
It is.
So this was a very easy segue to make.
Anyway, speaking of white supremacy, everything that's happening.
Yeah. Exactly. Trump's America, you know.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of, I'm tempted to go down the strict white supremacy road, but I really do want to spend a lot of time in the feminist space.
Sure.
And this critique of white feminism. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do some of that through a despicable character like Kellyanne Conway.
Absolutely.
And just to set it up for our listeners, there was a Hollywood Reporter piece that you shared with me, kind of, I think we can basically say it's a publicity type of piece about the rise of Kellyanne Conway. And then the New York Times followed up with sort of a hand-wringing piece about her and how she reflects in the world of feminism. So that's sort of the backdrop. And let's just start there. Like a person like her, who I think is safe to say is fairly problematic. I think the word I used beginning was despicable. But
yeah, you really de-escalated there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm going to flip back to despicable.
Yeah. And I'm being kind.
Yeah.
I'm really, really being kind.
All right. Easy now. Unless you want to turn this into a viral segment.
I don't, because I think that's the point of the argument, that she often is the subject of vitriol and targeting that is sexist in its nature. So let's just leave it there. Like, what are some thoughts on how to confront those two things?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the one place to start is to say, you know, absolutely, Kellyanne Conway is the subject of sexist attacks, and that's, you know, not okay. At the same time, Kellyanne Conway has done quite well for herself, and is in a position of power in which she wields power over other people's lives, including other women, and it's not a good feminist look, what she's doing, you know? So, I mean, that one piece that I sent you, she proclaims herself to be the image of the Trump supporter. Like, I'm the face of the Trump campaign. I'm the face of the Trump movement, I think she calls it. And I think that there's something in that doesn't get discussed quite enough. And part of what's in that is that, you know, 53% of white women voted for Trump. And so there's something about him that's appealing to white women, even though, you know, there was that horrible tape that was released of him talking about the pussy grab and all that. And there was this kind of collective gasp when that happened, and people thought, oh, well, that's it. It's over. He's never going to get the votes of women now. And still, 53% of white women voted for him. And here she is saying, I'm the face of the Trump movement. So what explains that? Well, part of my argument is that kind of white feminism, which is what she's really doing, is a kind of white liberal feminism where women get to be equal with white men, white women get to be equal with white men, is really consistent with white supremacy. If you have a feminism that doesn't take into account race at the very get-go, then you've got white supremacy. I mean, it's part of what they're doing at the Ladies Only Forum at Stormfront. You know, they're the white ladies at Stormfront are going, yeah, my job kind of sucks. I think I should get equal pay for equal work. I think white women should have a right to an abortion. I think gays and lesbians are fine as long as they're white nationalists. You know, their views.
there's a comedy sketch idea.
Okay. Well, there's Milo, right?
Well, I mean, Milo is I refuse to give him more publicity. He could not have been more boring. But yes, Milo is a good brand position for that stuff. But don't you also think, though, that there's also a major class dimension to it as well? Because I think that, to me, when you look at part of the reason that Kellyanne Conway in general can go out and say that she's like a embodiment of a certain type of feminist virtue is definitely partially what you're saying in terms of the racial reality and the breakdown. And I also just think, you know, 53% of white women voted for Trump because, you know, there's married white women tend to be Republicans and they voted for their nominee. And in some sense, to me, that's not terribly surprising. Like, there's a demographic that has always voted for what is in some ways a white identity party way before Trump and is willing to vote against women's health. Like, you know that's very consistent. But I think that the class dimension is that, you know, the way feminism started to get framed, and even with the Hillary Clinton campaign, just in terms of like the brand of like it's her turn and it's all just sort of about like a kind of identity positioning. I mean, Kellyanne Conway can say honestly by a certain way that we do frame this in the public that she is an embodiment of a certain feminist ideal. She's successful, she has a family, and she's married, but she's also incredibly, you know, wealthy and influential and blah, blah, blah. And when it gets reduced to that as both exercise and whiteness, but I think also really crucially something that's completely divorced from a really broad set of policy questions having to do with economics and equality and access, if it's just that kind of signifier, then she could actually, you know, she's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a class dimension, but I don't think it's not, I don't necessarily think that that's all that's going on with Kellyanne Conway. I mean, part of what's going on.
There's a lot going on with Kellyanne Conway.
one of the more amusing things that happened with Kellyanne Conway, you know, was the, I don't know if you remember her outfit for the inauguration, but she had this little...
The Minuteman.
The majorette sort of thing.
That was really... that was the image where I really legitimately... I went to the part of me that is like a old man with a Bible on a stoop. I was like, Armageddon. Times is a-coming. We ain't going to survive this, no.
Well, yeah. It was interesting because it's one of the places that she's pointed out that she got criticized, you know, and she pointed to that as a kind of sexism. And I actually disagree. I think that there have been sexist attacks against her, but I think critiquing that outfit was in no way sexist. It was just an observation of fact. But you know, her pushback on that in a subsequent interview was, I didn't mean to offend the black stretch pant wearing women of America. And the reporter who was interviewing her said, what do you mean by that? Like, who is that? She said, well, I don't know. Look at any mall or airport in America, and they, the black stretch pant women of America, won't wear anything that buttons, fastens, or hooks. And I just thought, that's such a fascinating distinction to make, you know? And to me, what she was saying by defending the majorette uniform that she wore to the inauguration and sort of casting herself against the black stretch pant wearing women of the world is a sort of reframe of ladyhood. You know, like a proper lady wears things that button and that fasten, you know?
A proper lady looks like a neo-Nazi Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And in some ways you could say that's about class because there are only certain women who have access to a Gucci-made majorette uniform. But it's also about white womanhood, you know, and there's this strain. Some of the work that I've done has looked at this strain of white womanhood through American culture going back through decades and centuries even. And there's a way in which white women get to be fancy in a particular kind of way that's not available to other women, right, of other racial backgrounds, right? And that's partly about class, but it's also very much about gender, and it's also about a kind of conservative politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you say that. There's two points I want to bring up. Is that one, when she talked about, you know, these fastens and hooks, and I hadn't seen that comment, but it reminds me of the decree from the Trump White House that they want women to dress, quote unquote, like women, whatever, however they define that. So there is that piece of it. And then there was sort of the uproar about the picture that was taken of her with her heels in the on the couch and all that kind of stuff, which was something, you know, there are many reasons to despise her. I didn't really care about that one. But in the frame of this conversation, there is that sort of liberty that people perceived her taking with a office that is sacred and a certain level of comfort merely because of her whiteness.
Yeah, absolutely. The you know, the shoes and the feet on the sofa was just offensive to many of us on many levels. But I think that, you know, there is a kind of way in which white people and sometimes especially white women want to have it both ways. You know, this kind of appeal to propriety, you know, wear something that buttons or fastens or zips, you know, and at the same time, she's putting her feet on the sofa, you know. So it's a kind of double standard where really anything that she does goes.
And I think there's a always, it seems to me, like a tension in feminist movements between women of color and white women, as they've labeled and we've talked about and used the term white feminism. And in even more recently, you know, not to always put everything through the guise of celebrity, but I think it's at least useful to demonstrate a point where Emma Watson, who's been an outspoken proponent of feminism, but then whenever it was a year or two ago, she critiqued Beyonce for certain videos or whatever it was that she said. But then recently she came under attack for either Vogue or Vanity Fair spread that showed like some underboob, and that became like a thing.
Disgusting.
Yeah, terrible.
The technical term, the underboob.
Yeah, I think it was underboob, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So,
but it's called stealth titty.
There you go. I like that even better. Stealth titty.
I'm on it. Yeah, I got you.
You know, so there's that, you know, yeah, where you have this woman who she's defending herself, but yet didn't see that same argument when she used the same attack against Beyonce.
Yeah, I mean, she, you know, I mean, Emma Watson, who has positioned herself as a kind of UN spokesperson for feminism around
anybody
the world.
Anybody can become a UN spokesperson. Know,
apparently, yeah, they're just handing those out like chiclets now.
Yeah, just throw those out there.
But she went on the attack against Beyonce, and there's been this kind of, she's not the only one, you know, there's been a string of white women who have questioned Beyonce's feminism, which is just not very smart, first of all. And so part of what Emma Watson was saying, it was a couple of years ago when she was looking at the Lemonade video, like there's something about that there's too much of her boobs in this. And that seems to me a very male gaze. She comes out with her titties on this cover, and you know, and then people attack her for that. And she says, "It's my feminism is bigger than my titties."
I should hope so.
I hope so.
There you go.
Sorry, Emma Watson. I'm going to see Beauty and the Beast this weekend.
Yeah, I'm not.
All
there's not enough in the male gaze in it for me. Sorry. Right.
So, you know, so again, Emma Watson has the same kind of, you know, position that Kellyanne Conway is in, right? Where she wants to have it both ways, right? She wants to be able to critique Beyonce for having too many boobs in this video, and yet she wants to be defended when it's her boobs that are under attack as not being, you know, feminist or whatever.
Where does the point come? Because I think now we're sort of like running an interesting drawing these connections deeper and deeper, because, you know, I think obviously it's easy for all of us to despise Kellyanne Conway.
Super
and it's
easy.
Quite easy to see how, I mean, another, and I mean, look, granted, she was sort of amazingly, even by Trump standards, ludicrous at her job. But to me, it's like, you know, Katrina Pearson didn't get the hookup and she was out with the rest of these people. That to me is even like another little side racial story of these people. And then we go to Emma Watson and the Beyonce thing. And, you know, I mean, it's just sort of obviously ill-advised that she's trying to do, like, it sounded to me when she said it, like a little bit of like a knockoff bell hooks critique of Beyonce. Bell hooks went after Beyonce a couple years ago in a way that actually seemed a little puritanical, too, in my male gaze-infused reading. But I guess what it leads me to, though, and I think that this is an Where do we start getting to a point when in these conversations where people are aware of their position and where they're speaking from and noting it, which is vital, but then at the same time, they're still like, say, you know, I wish I could think of a stronger example, but it's like, say in the hypothetical, what if Emma Watson actually had a valid position, you know, critique of Beyonce that actually was well considered and articulate and maybe, you know, could have been responded to or shot down, but it wasn't something that was so innately ridiculous that we could just sort of mock her for having, but actually had some substance to it. How would that interplay with just the very fact of the racial dynamic? Like, how do we kind of balance that? Because I think I've seen in some discourses, particularly online, where you're at, and this is not a problem in the real world because it's just not the reality of power structures and politics, but I see social media conversations where it's like, well, actually someone just pretty validly critiqued an idea you put forward. And your response is, you know, well, you're fill in the blank, so you can't comment on that. Or, you want to criticize, a good example, you know, criticize. I saw people responding to very serious criticisms of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy in Libya or something with like, oh, well, you know, you don't think women should be able to have drones, you're sexist, you know. So I think what I'm wondering is how do we strike this balance and discourse of understanding positionality, but then also not using it to evade conversation either, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the question's really on, you know, in your hypothetical, I think the burden is really on Emma Watson, right?
Right.
To be more self-reflexive and to sort of say, wow, I realize that I'm white, you know, and that shapes my worldview.
Right.
It shapes the kinds of things I pay attention to. It shapes the kinds of things I ignore. It shapes the kinds of breaks I get in the press coverage about myself, right, as a celebrity.
Right.
And I think that's really what's going on in these conversations where it seems maybe as an outsider to the conversation, well, how you can't speak on that because you're X, Y, or Z. You have this identity in terms of race, gender, or class.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's underneath that is a more serious call to push people to be reflexive, to reflect on their own position in how that shapes what they're saying and what they're reacting to. And I think that's what's missing, you know, whether it's Emma Watson or Taylor Swift or Kellyanne Conway or, you know, any number of celebrities. Mm-hmm. There's just no kind of reflection of, oh, right, I have my own shit in this, and let me be critical of that as well, you know, before I open my mouth about somebody else.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the celebrities are always like, they're good instructional tools because everyone knows them. Right. So it's a really good example to reason from. But I think to Michael's point, you see that devolution in conversation mm-hmm. consistently, you know, even among your peer groups are online where there's such animus mm-hmm. the minute someone reflects on something that's different from this kind of what's stated and accepted mm-hmm. in this world as being right. And, you know, how is the challenge of the left or progressive movements to coalesce all of these different opinions and ideas and identities to form a cohesive, like, dedicated front against the opposition, which seems to move in uniform?
I agree. And I also just have to add the addendum to that I'm where I could, you know, I could say that some of my concerns about this did arise in very specifically political context in Democratic primary, which I'm not interested in relitigating with people, but I totally saw that devolution of, like, well, you know, I almost saw people trying to turn, like, you know, an advocacy for universal health care into some sort of bizarre stealth, like, pro-patriarchy, white male thing. Mm-hmm. And then, so there was this radical devolution and just complete distortion of the type of insights you're talking about, just to sort of, like, basic cheap political stupidity, which, like Phil is saying, it's bad in and of itself for discourse, but it adds a higher pressure for the left to kind of get synchronized in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, there's a long history of the left eating our own. You know, I mean, it's just that's what we've done for many decades, and I don't know that this is necessarily speeding it up, but I think there are ways in which social media and the kind of intensity of getting into those, you know, in the old days we called them flame wars, but those kinds of heated
flame wars.
Oh,
okay, gotcha. Sounds right.
You know, those kind of heated, intense battles that feel so personal sometimes are, and feel so intimate, even though there's this distance and disconnect, you know? So I think that there's something about those conversations happening in digital media that changes the quality and the tenor of them in a way that's as important in some ways as the identity politics part of it.
So is there like an emotional intelligence that is needed
in
social media?
It's called close the laptop and go for a walk around the block. Ooh,
there you go.
All right.
Turn off your phone. Take a breath. Real life is also happening.
But we're not going to do that. Like, we know we're not doing that.
Oh, yeah, I do it all the time.
I mean, I turn
you
stuff off.
You do it. You do it. You're actually, the way you manage your phone's incredible, dude. You don't even have all these notifications going
on.
Yeah,
I don't even have email on my phone. Yeah. So
there you go.
Yeah.
See?
Like, possible. I didn't see your email until I opened up the laptop. Yeah. You know, so I try to tell people, like, if you need me, text me by the time I'm moving. But nonetheless, like, we are litigating these things online, and these movements that you talked about, to kind of go back full circle to the white nationalist, white supremacist movements, they're creating these memes, these conversations, this sort of distortion of history and fact online.
Yeah.
You know, and so these ideas are becoming more and more entrenched. You know, if you're getting your news from Daily Caller and Breitbart and all of these sites,
like the president, you mean?
Yeah, like the regime. Yeah. How do you balance that against other things like Stormfront and all these sites that you talked about? Their world is becoming a normalized worldview.
Yeah, there's something that media scholars talk about called the Overton window, right? Where what's acceptable moves as someone says something more outrageous and more outrageous and more outrageous. And what we're witnessing is the Overton window moving in real time through this new media ecosystem. You know, I think about this a lot, and I don't really know what the answer is, but we're definitely living through a kind of seismic shift in media that's having an impact in the material world, right? I mean, in my classes, you know, we talk about the shift from, you know, we used to talk about broadcast media, the one-to-many model, and then the shift to the peer-to-peer, the many-to-many model. We've shifted into some new model that I haven't heard anybody name yet, but it's definitely having an impact on social relations, on the material world, and I don't know what the solution is to that.
Damn it.
Yeah. I know.
Professor, come on.
I wanted a solution. I'm desperate for one.
Yeah, we all are.
Ready
we
for
are
a blueprint here.
Because this is exhausting. I feel like in a state of like, I don't know. It's like trauma all the time.
Is. Well, it is. Yeah, it is traumatic. It is. It's really disturbing.
I was hoping for a solution. I'm bummed.
I wonder if, and I know we got to wrap soon, but my only sort of thing is somehow distinguishing between like, and this is a digital conversation because the real world and the actual material conditions are, I still want to make some, I mean, they're affecting the material world very much, like you say, but I still want to make some distinction there. But I think that we have to somehow calibrate like the outrage cycle because it's just so continuous and it's so constant. And in the way that in these mediums where we're not making distinctions, it's like, you know, I see some people responding in the same way that, you know, if Trump insults Meryl Streep or something, it's almost like, you know, not quite, but almost the same levels if they're responding to like documenting what ICE is doing to undocumented people across this country. Mm-hmm. And I just think on some level, one of the most basic things that we can start doing is just strategically and emotionally really starting to bracket these distinctions and realize that even if it comes to you in one torrent on all of your different feeds, these are radically different things in the real world.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that what this new regime is teaching us all is how to dial all that down or to maybe not even dial it down, but to parse it.
Yes.
You know, with more more judgment, more wisdom.
Absolutely.
We definitely wisdom.
Wisdom needed.
Yeah, wisdom needed. Or Stevie Wonder would say, we need some love.
We do need some love.
But not in that corny Van Jones way.
No. Yeah.
That motherfucker Van Jones
really, really, really hurt it. You know what is amazing about Van Jones is that Van Jones and that comment for everybody, and people, a bunch of people tweeted us saying that that needed to be the brand F up.
Yeah.
And I mean, he...
Say what it was.
Oh, yeah, I'll explain what it was. So basically, Van Jones said in the moment where in President Trump's joint address to Congress, where he, in the process of lying about the success of a mission in Yemen, which killed several children, many civilians, and one Navy SEAL, he gave some sort of saccharine shout out to the guy's wife, and it was actually a really sort of twisted thing, even by the standards of these people.
Yeah, it was super
gross. But somehow, and I have to say though, in a twisted way, it was actually much more. It was more presidential. That particular thing was actually much more in keeping with recent presidential bullshit of all stripes, to be honest. But Van Jones went on CNN and said that in that moment, he became the president of all of us. And I mean, what was amazing to me, though, about that thing was that Van Jones, who I have a soft spot for in some ways and has some leftism in his background and is, you know, whatever, he's an articulate guy, but I saw people responding to it, like both to me personally asking me to comment on it and in general media who were like, their public profiles are way more like centrist, white, whatever, than Van Jones. And their response was, would you smack him in the fucking mouth? Like, what is he talking about? So, I mean, he really hurt himself with that. No, we need some...
Van Jones is hustling for them checks.
We need some Bob Marley, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, he's on them, love checks.
No, yeah. Well, we all love checks. That's on point.
Professor Jesse Daniels, want to thank you so much
pleasure.
For coming
this
in.
This is great.
I'm glad we made it finally.
Yeah,
took
exactly.
us years.
I know, right?
Thanks this for coming great. In. My thank pleasure. You. Hope you do it again soon.
And that's On Point.